facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Fantastic Friday to you. Thanks for joining me today. Got an amazing, amazing show lined up for you. I can't wait to get started. It's going to be so much fun. Let me give you the number to call, 1-888-914-9149. It's a toll-free studio line for The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. You're definitely going to want to call in and talk to today's guest. He is a lot of fun. And you can also reach me on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And of course, there is the stalwart show account, at Cale Clark Show. And you can email us, cale@relevantradio.com. Want to get right to it. I have an amazing guest who's waiting patiently on the line. He hails from Montreal, Quebec, where he grew up. His family were actually non-practicing Lutherans from Germany. And as you know, tomorrow, of course, Halloween is the 503rd anniversary. It's been over half a millennium now of the Protestant Reformation, which was touched off, or the Protestant Revolution, depending on how you want to look at it, which was touched off on October the 31st, 1517, when an obscure German professor of theology named Martin Luther launched it all by nailing his 95 theses, his famous 95 theses, to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg. And that's what started it all. And my guest today does come from a Lutheran background. When he was a teenager, he converted to Catholicism thanks to the help of a friend who talked to him about the Bible and brought him to Mass on a regular basis. And that had a deep, deep impact on him. And of course, he was also a guest on The Journey Home back in 2004 on EWTN. He has a degree in art history from the famous McGill University in Montreal. And he also has a master's from Laval University in Quebec City. He later went to Rome to study theology and was ordained as a priest of the Prelature of Opus Dei in 1994. He had the opportunity to meet St. John Paul II, Pope John Paul the Great, during a synod of bishops where he worked as a translator. He speaks six languages. Six, count them, six. I only speak three. English, French, and profanity. No, I'm only kidding. You don't want to... Oh, boy. He is now the chaplain of Earnscliffe College, a student residence in Toronto at the University of Toronto, and he's also the chaplain of the Hawthorne School for Girls. And since the pandemic started a few months ago, he started a couple of great online initiatives. He's got a fantastic YouTube channel where he posts meditations and talks from recollections, which are kind of like mini retreats that you can watch on his YouTube channel, which you can find at youtube.com/... Well, I'll tell you his name in just a second, so I'll save that part for later. And on his podcast called In Your Presence, which is a beautiful podcast. It can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts and download them. Basically, meditations from priests of Opus Dei, where you can really use those as the soundtrack for your personal prayer, for your mental prayer. He's done a lot of TV work as well, notably on Salt and Light Television, where he goes to famous museums and looks at the works of famous artists and talks about how it relates to the faith. And that's really going to be the topic of today's conversation. My guest is Father Eric Nicolai. Father, thank you for joining us on the program. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here with you.
And now that I revealed your name, I can also reveal the name of your YouTube channel, which is okay, youtube.com/Eric Nicolai. And that is spelled E-R-I-C-N-I-C-O-L-A-I, Eric Nicolai. And Father, tell me a little bit about that spiritual journey of yours, converting from Lutheranism, of course, on the eve of the anniversary of the Protestant Revolution. How did that all come about for you?
Well, I mean, I grew up, as I said, in a non-practicing family. We were Lutheran, but we never went to church or anything. And I had a friend who was a very close friend in high school. And, well, I would often accompany him to Mass, not because I wanted to go to Mass, but just because he was my friend, and we'd talk on the way and listen to music and things like that. And then he at one point said, "Okay, look, you gotta stop talking, you gotta help me to pray." I said, "What do you mean? Like, yeah, you gotta help me to pray the rosary, because I want to say the rosary, and this is how you say it." And he had me memorize the rosary, like the Hail Marys and stuff. And so I was praying, quote unquote praying. He said, "You don't have to pray, you just have to help me pray by you saying the Hail Mary." So I was actually kind of like praying for him, even though I didn't know it. And then bit by bit, we talked about the faith, and he taught me what the Blessed Sacrament was, and he had a great Eucharistic piety. He would go and do visits to the Blessed Sacrament, and I never knew that our Blessed Lord was present there, truly present in the Blessed Sacrament, and you could see it, but just the way he would pray there, you know, so it was quite impressive. And then with not very much time, I eventually was received into the church in 1982.
Okay, well,
so that's a little bit how it started.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. And obviously you have this master's degree in art history, and that's what I really want to talk to you about tonight, art and the faith, because all of us have this thirst for beauty. And of course, beautiful images of art have often been related to the faith. And what I wanted to ask you about to start off with is, what were some of the earliest images of art relating to the Catholic faith that have ever appeared?
Well, if you look at the earliest you can find would have to be the catacombs, right? When the church was still quite unofficial, and the only thing it could do is just bury the dead, right? And you had to go outside of Rome, outside of the actual perimeter of Rome, and you know, the Via Appia, and go to places like the catacombs of Saint Calixtus and other places like that, and they would bury them, and there were like lots of Christians that were buried. And then, well, it occurred to somebody to start decorating them, and these were places of burial. They were underground, they were damp, and of course they did not decorate them in order to adorn them, but really to tell a sacred tale, to teach people what was going on there, right? It was a way to show, well, what we are doing here is in continuity with the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, and it's now coming to fruition in the New. And so a lot of the earliest images show, for example, Adam and Eve. So Adam, you know, is the old Adam, and Christ is the new Adam. Eve and the new Mary is the new Eve. Or just even like we have little frescoes, very, very, very simple images. For example, the fish and the loaves. We have the Jesus the Good Shepherd. We have the three young men in the fiery furnace, right? And everything was kind of seen as a fulfillment, you could say, of the Old Testament dispensation, right? And I mean, Christians were being arrested, and but there was just a desire to sort of adorn those, not for decorative purposes, but more for didactic purposes, I would say. Even though they had some decorative elements in that too.
And of course, when you mentioned didactic purposes, you're talking about teaching the faith. And it's true throughout the centuries. My guest is Father Eric Nicolai, by the way, on the Cale Clark Show, art historian. Throughout the centuries, obviously, you know, with literacy rates not being that great, it's not that people weren't smart, but not everybody could read or write in the early centuries of the church. The faith was often communicated through art, wasn't it?
Yes, I mean, if you look, for example, at the early Christological errors, right? I mean, there were heresies in the early church, right? That I mean, Christ obviously is the center of our faith. I mean, he is the Son of God who made man, and so. But what is he? Is he just a man? Is he God and man? Is he just God? And what exactly is he, right? And so, I mean, that led to different, I guess, theories and different ideas, and eventually with the Christological councils, well, they had to be resolved. But at the same time, they could also be explained through simple images. And one of the earliest ways was, of course, through images both of Christ and of our Blessed Mother, Our Lady, right? And some of the earliest images we see of Our Lady, those are among the earliest, like they were icons. Mm-hmm. And we have, for example, the account of the mother of Constantine, the emperor. So we're talking like the 4th century and even earlier, that she ends up going to out east to Constantinople, and she goes to Jerusalem, but she discovers there an image that is attributed to Saint Luke. As you know, Saint Luke, he has a detailed description of the early life of Jesus and the nativity and so forth, and the childhood. And she discovers there an icon of Our Lady with Jesus, right? And this just, wow, man, she actually brings it back, and it starts to be copied over and over. And this is a sort of a copy of that is today in Santa Maria Maggiore, is one of Pope Francis's favorite churches. And what you see there is you see Our Lady, and she's kind of with her hand, she's kind of like got Jesus on her lap, but she's kind of like pointing to Jesus. And the title of that kind of image is called in Greek, hodegateria, which means she who points the way to salvation, right? So she's wow. basically this here, that is my son, is the way to salvation. So he is the way, right? And so these images became, well, venerated. And I mean, they took on, I mean, huge value for the faithful, because they reaffirmed those Christological truths that were, well, being, you know, doubted by some people, right? So, but to have ordinary people be able to say, oh, here's the way. And who is showing it? Mm-hmm. Our Lady. She is not just the mother of Jesus. She is the mother of God, right? He's not just a man. He is the mother. She is the mother of God. He is God, right? So a simple image, it doesn't say this is God, but it tells you that just by the beauty of the image, you know, the nobility of it. And of course, these images are always repeated. I mean, they're not, mm-hmm. let's say, quote unquote, original. This is not the originality of the artist that is a question. It's really, you know, like a kind of a protocol that represents something very, very, very important, and that people came to see as truly, like, almost like relics, and very, very, very holy in that sense, right? And even the person painting them would not just paint, they call it writing an icon, so that
writing an icon, paint, wow.
they would be praying as they would produce these icons, right?
Wow, that's
this is
fantastic.
In the Eastern tradition, right? And mm-hmm. so they helped the faithful a lot. And one of the icons that I really enjoyed looking at, and I sort of gave talks about this as well, is the for example, the earliest representations of the nativity, right? The nativity scenes, right? Like when we think of the nativity, we often think, of course, of Christmas. I mean, Christmas is still around the corner. It's not terribly far, right? And what do we do when it's Christmas time? Well, we send Christmas cards, right? We send Christmas cards. And of course...
I don't. I'm really bad at that. I'm terrible.
Well, it was a tradition to send a Christmas, but you know how we kind of lament sending cards with just like a Christmas tree, like or you know,
right,
just like you know, the generic
happy holidays,
season's greetings or whatever. Yeah. But there was a long tradition of representing the nativity, and now so there's an Eastern tradition and there's a Western tradition, and the Eastern tradition is very different from what we know today. We are more perhaps familiar with the Western tradition, but the Eastern tradition shows the Our Lady in a cave, and she's lying down. She's kind of like resting because she's just given mm-hmm. birth, so she's resting. Sometimes she's sewn in a kind of a bed of sorts, and Jesus is not in so much in a manger as in a kind of a coffin, and he's tightly wound up in swaddling clothes, almost to look like he's in a coffin, like literally. You know, it's like a presage of his death, right? That he's
right.
going to die. And if you look at some of those, you think, hey, is this, and he looks like a little mini man, you know, and that's kind of like dead. And Mary's lying down, she's resting, and Joseph is always outside the cave. He's not inside. We often see him in the Western tradition as kneeling and Mary kneeling inside the cave, but no, he was not allowed. This was a very sacred place. He could not go in there. And very often in these icons, you see him standing, and next to him is this.
Well, wait. Before you say that, Father, that, we have to take a really quick break. I know
okay,
what you're going to
no
say,
problem.
And it's super, super exciting. But we just have to take a really, really quick station
okay,
break here.
No problem.
And by the way, you're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Father Eric Nicolai. We're talking about the faith in art. You are going to be very surprised by what you hear about what was outside the cave, or who was outside the cave with St. Joseph in these early depictions of the Nativity. Hey, there's Handel's Messiah. Yeah, listen, let's get through Thanksgiving first, guys, okay? We'll talk about Advent and Christmas. We'll be back in just a moment on The Cale Clark Show.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Back to the show. Judging from our usual playlist, this might be a departure for you, but I do like classical music as well. We're talking about classical works of art and how they help explain the faith and how beauty points us to the truth. My guest today is Father Eric Nicolai, who is the creator of the amazing podcast, In Your Presence. I hope you go download that. These are meditations that will help you to pray. And also, he has a fantastic YouTube channel, youtube.com/Eric Nicolai. You can find it there. And just before the break, we were talking about the nativity in art and how a lot of great theological themes are presented in the early images of the nativity. And we talked about how really, you know, Mary, the baby Jesus, Saint Joseph, not really depicted in a stable per se, but rather, this is probably actually quite historical too. Mary's giving birth in a cave. That's probably how it actually went down in a certain sense. And Saint Joseph is always standing outside the cave, but there's someone or something else standing next to him. Isn't there, Father Eric?
Yes, yes, there is. There is. And it's rather rather sinister, because there was a kind of a legend, I guess you could call it that. A legend probably has it or had its origin in some of the apocryphal gospels that were circulating at the time. And you see Joseph, he's kind of depicted kind of leaning on his staff, kind of with his head on his hand, kind of half asleep, but kind of looking in. And in front of him is this rather hairy, burly-looking guy who looks like he's wearing, kind of looks like he's wearing a feather suit. It depends on which kind of icon you look at. But it looks like he's got all these feathers, and he's pointing his finger right at Joseph's face. And he's basically, so that's all you see. And if you don't know the story, you wouldn't know what it is. But everybody knew. Everybody who saw that would know that this is the legend of the devil that appeared to Joseph and said, "You think that that child is your child? It's not your child, you know. And this is not the Son of God." And you know, he said, "Reject him, reject him." And you know, do not think that this is. So, in other words, it is the devil tempting Joseph to think that Our Lady was, well, actually unfaithful, you know, and that that is not his child, and that this, and this is the product of a human, you know, human intervention. And he's kind of there tense, and he's looking in, and the story is that he says, go away, devil, right? And the devil does indeed go away, and then he's able to go in to be with Mary. But this shows the moment, of course, of his temptation, and it created a kind of a tension in the scene, because you see this ugly devil, right? But that's you could say that's iconography. You know, we don't always have the vocabulary, but iconography, anybody would have, at that time, would have said, oh, that's the devil. And then people would have been, you know, aware that, you know, you got to be aware of the devil and so forth, right? And then on the other side, we also see the midwives. There was a story. Well, that was just shown, you know, that's how children were washed, and they showed midwives, two midwives cleaning the child, right? And it seems to say, I don't know if it meant to do that. It seems to suggest like almost as though it were a baptism of sorts, right? But that's also one of the elements in this, in the iconography of the early Eastern icons.
Well, that's really really fascinating stuff. My guest is Father Eric Nicolai, art historian. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. If you have a question for Father Eric, you can call 1-888-914-9149. Once again, 1-888-914-9149. I think it was really fascinating what you were just saying, Father, about how everybody back then would have known the categories. They know what these images mean. And on our sister program, The Faith Explained, I'm right now going through the book of Revelation. I'm talking about apocalyptic literature and how once we sort of know the code, once we know what these generally known images mean, and everybody kind of knew what these images were back in the day. We don't now. But once you know the code, it's actually a pretty easy book to understand. It's interesting to know that that was the case in the world of art when it comes to the faith too.
No, I mean, the art was like almost like a second Bible for many people. I mean, we know, for example, that all all scenes of the Nativity always show, for example, an ass and an ox, right? Mm-hmm. There's always an ass and an ox, both in the Eastern tradition and later on in the Western tradition. But of course, there's no mention of an ass and an ox in the Gospels, right? They didn't say they went and sat next to an ass and an ox. Where does the ass and the ox come from, right? Well, the tradition is that it came from Isaiah, who says the ox knows his owner, the ass his master's crib. But Israel has not known me. My people have not understood. Right? That's from Isaiah. And then the prophet Habakkuk said, between two animals, you have been made manifest. Right? There's even sarcophaguses that show that, right? So that's from Isaiah and from Habakkuk, so Old Testament prophets. But, of course, artists would incorporate those into this iconography. And we come to take for granted as though an ass and ox. Mm-hmm. But everybody kind of understood what this meant, because the ox was seen as it was a clean animal, so it was seen as Israel, and the ass was seen as the Gentiles, because, well, for the Jews, the ass was an unclean animal, right? Mm-hmm. So the unity of the two looking, and sometimes if you look carefully, you'll see the ass is looking down, and the ox is looking up. He's kind of like, the ass is looking down right at the baby, whereas the ox is looking up. It's like he's missing it. You're missing out, dude. You're like you, come on, man. Look down here, you know. And this is more emphasized in other you know, paintings. But look at any representation of the Nativity and check out what the ass and the ox are doing. And that'll give you an idea. You know? But they represent Israel and the Gentiles.
That is really, really fascinating. And, you know, someone just texted me here saying we could apply that definition maybe to the political parties that are out there right now. I don't know if I want to get into that, but we do have a phone call right now for Father Eric. It's Fernando, who is calling from Buena Park, California. Fernando, welcome to the show. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Hello, Father Nicolai.
Hello.
I have a question about, since you are an art historian, and especially with, you know, religious figures, we were given a beautiful, I mean, it's like, I'm guessing it's at least 3x5. It's a picture of a two baby angels, and I don't know if they're called seraphim and cherubim, but they look like babies, and they're looking up. I mean, it looks like they're in the sky, but they're looking up, and they have the little wings. And I'm not sure if there's cloud figures, but so what is there something symbolic about those two angels?
Well, I mean, in the Bible, there are numerous different levels of angels, right? There are seraphim, there are what they call potestas or power. I don't know exactly how they call them in English, but there are archangels, angels, and then the guardian angels. There's sort of different levels. And so, especially in the Baroque period, right, the idea of incorporating little, what they call them putti, honestly, I don't right offhand know the origin of the term, but they're like small little angels that are there simply to kind of adorn a scene, like a nativity scene or like a adoration scene, and they adorn it, but they are literally like physical little babies with little wings on them. And then we see them certainly in people like Rubens and Caravaggio, not so much Caravaggio, but a lot of the Lanné brothers and other famous artists of the Baroque period, right?
I wonder if that's where the word cutie comes from originally. I don't know. I just thought of that. But usually when angels appear, they don't appear so cute and cuddly in the scripture. Isn't that right, Father? A little bit more terrifying usually, right? Oh, have we lost? Oh, we just lost Father. He's going to come back. We're going to get him back on the phone. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest today is Father Eric Nicolai, who's an art historian. He's just giving us a fascinating tour through the history of art and how really art was used as a medium for catechesis and how to teach the faith. And he talked earlier about how a lot of early art pieces, such as the Pantocrator, that famous image of Christ, talked about the divinity of Christ, how he is all-powerful, because most of the heresies in the early church period, most of the false teachings about Christ happened in those early centuries, and art was a weapon that the church used to fight against it. And it's also interesting, too, if you've ever seen this image of the Pantocrator, how the image of Christ corresponds point by point to the image on the Shroud of Turin, which is just fascinating. Yeah. It's almost as if the Shroud was used as a model for the Pantocrator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, what I would say with regards to the depiction of Christ, right, in the early period, is that there were the different ways of representing him. You could represent him in frescoes, like in the Good Shepherd. You could represent him in sarcophaguses in, you know, very highly hewn scenes. But what I would say is that he's never represented suffering, right? Mm. Jesus is never shown on the cross suffering. Like when we go to any church today, you will see a crucifix, right, with Jesus in some way suffering. And it's but this was not the way that the early Christians represented Christ, like on a cross. This came much, much later. Like literally, it came as late as the 13th and 14th century, and it was very much related to the historical period. So in the early church, like you say, with those heresies, well, the church had to reaffirm the divinity of Christ. So that's why he's shown very much, let's say, godlike. If you show him, you know, suffering, It doesn't seem to reemphasize, you know, his divinity. And in fact, some say that like the church was still like having a hard time taking in the reality of the crucifixion. Like they were still sort of suffering. Yeah. And to represent him still like that was just too much. So if you look at the early second century sarcophaguses, and there would have been earlier ones even than that. I'm talking about like the Junius Bassus sarcophaguses, what we have left today. It shows Jesus. Well, yeah, he's on a cross, but he looks like Apollo. I mean, this guy is like Rocky. I mean, he's super, he's tough. He, you know, he's not gonna, you know, hurt. He's very powerful looking, and he gives you confidence, right? Or there's one where he's shown on a donkey and you know, obviously referring to the entry into Jerusalem, right? So, but it's only much later, in particular in the 14th, 13th, and especially in the 14th century in Germany, that you get what they call, in German, they call it Andachtsbilder, which means basically devotional pieces that show Jesus at the most excruciating time of his suffering. So he's shown, sometimes being taken down from the cross, or in the moment of flagellation, and he's just covered in blood. And some of them also show him standing in a tomb, right? The tomb that he's going to be placed in, right? Mm-hmm. And that corresponds, interestingly enough, it corresponds also to the time of the pandemic of the Black Death, right?
Wow.
So people were kind of thinking, okay, we have the Black Death. People are dying in droves. This is basically, we have to make atonement. And atonement for our sins. Our sins caused all this. And one way that they did it was that they meditated on these very, you know, dramatic images of our Lord. And they're very, very powerful. You know, I recommend you go and look at them. I'm just trying to think of, especially in Germany and in Netherlands. You know, Dirk Bouts has some, and anyway, there's a number of them that they're very powerful.
My guest is Father Eric Nicolai, art historian on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. That's just so fascinating how these images of a suffering Christ really kind of came forth during a pandemic time. And I almost think maybe some modern Catholic artists are probably preparing right now some icons of saints wearing, you know, surgical masks or something to do with COVID. But I don't know if that's the next phase of art. Hopefully not. But I do want to talk about one period of art that is often given a bad rap, in my opinion. It's the Baroque period. And you often hear it said, if it ain't Baroque, don't fix it. But I love Baroque. I just love it. You know, on my one trip to Rome, which was on my honeymoon, my wife and I went to the Vatican Museums, and we looked around at a lot of Baroque art, and I just love the realism of it. But tell me a little bit about how that type of art in that period kind of was part of the Catholic Counter-Reformation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're in the 16th century, and this is, of course, a time that was quite difficult for the church. There were a lot of changes happening in the world, the printing press, which was a new technology that brought the spread of many, many heresies and lots of misinformation, you know, mm-hmm. and many priests lacked good formation at that time. Churches were in disarray. Many bishops were absent from their sees. And so, as we mentioned earlier, the appearance of preachers like Martin Luther. So the Council of Trent reacted and responded really in three major ways. By first clarifying the perennial nature of the doctrine that had been inherited from the apostolic tradition, then it renewed and unified the liturgy, right? Like gave it specific standards, and then it just emphasized just the moral demands of Christianity. That's what the Council of Trent did. And to do this, it did this through the example of the saints, the writings, and art. Right? And art. I mean, art was a very fundamental instrument to bring this about. And so there was even very specific indications in the council itself. And there was a famous cardinal, you may not have heard of him, but from Bologna. His name was Cardinal Gabriele Pagliotti from Bologna. Mm-hmm. And he spearheaded all these efforts in the mid-16th century. He came out with a treatise on the discourse, it's called the Discourse on Images, against precisely the Protestant iconoclasts who didn't want churches. They didn't want the images. They didn't want crucifixes, none of that, right? Mm-hmm. So, but also he was reacting to a lot of the art in churches that had lost, you could say, their purpose, right? He even called some of the art, his contemporary art, so from the 16th or 15th century, what we call, for example, mannerist art, he called that the devil's tool. I mean, because, you know, it showed sometimes these rather contorted images, people, you know, lots of nudity and things like that. I mean, this is not good. He said, like dude, we gotta do something that help people, see art as the silent preachers alongside the real preachers, right? Like the art has to be like a silent preacher to help people. And so the council, thanks to this guy, Gabriele Pagliotti, developed these principles of clarity in art, intelligibility, and a stimulus towards piety. Now that's what religious art, not regular art. Not, I mean, you do what you want if you, with other art, but religious mm-hmm. art had to be clear. You had to know what is this, right? Mm-hmm. It had to be intelligible, and of course, it had to stimulate you to pray. And one of the ways to stimulate you to pray is with drama, with light, with diagonals, movement, right? Not overly kind of boring, representations of these great, great mysteries. Because after all, our faith is beautiful. I mean, it's super beautiful, right? So the way we represent it has to fill us with hope, with optimism, with diamonds. When you said you went to Rome and you saw all that, that's because they were representing the beauty of the faith. You know, it shouldn't leave us with anxiety. It's incarnating the beauty of our faith. You know, that's why religious art should be like insanely beautiful, right? But it should be clear, harmonious, and that means it takes time. You have to invest money. It's too bad that in many places we don't always invest that much in beautiful churches. You know?
Yeah, I want to ask you a little bit about that after our next break. I do really want to get into this in just a couple of minutes, but just before we go to break, I want to ask you really, really quickly. Yeah. By the way, my guest is Father Eric Nicolai here on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. You can call in and talk to Father Eric, 1-888-914-9149. The Sistine Chapel, it's obviously super famous now, and you can see images of it, of course, on the internet, but for a long time, nobody had really seen this, and were the images very shocking to people at that time, Michelangelo's work?
Well, I mean, Michelangelo was kind of set on trial, right? When he produced that, I mean, because you know, certainly Gabriele Pagliotti, the cardinal, just like he said, "Whoa, this is like I'm not into this," because it had elements of all these very flamboyant images, like lots of nudity, pagan mythology in there, and he was very, very heavily criticized at the time. Even though, I mean, he painted from 1536 to 1541, so it took a long time, and he was, you know, very sort of focused, and you know, he was obviously a great artist. I'm not denying that, obviously, and he mm-hmm. did other paintings like the Pietà, right? The Pietà, we right. all know the Pietà, right? See, I can say the Pietà, and everybody knows what the Pietà is, right? I don't have exactly. to show you image. I mean, that shows you, and for that matter, it's sort of the same with the Final Judgment, but I don't think people know the degree because, you know, it's so convoluted, you could say, right? But mm-hmm. definitely when he painted the Last Judgment, like they didn't like, for example, the fact that Jesus looks like an Apollo god. He's practically mm-hmm. turning away from Our Lady, right? And in fact, during his trial about this, they said that he represented even Our Lady without clothes, which wasn't true. He had put clothes on her, but if you look at our Lord, like he's like turning away, it looks like doesn't look very inviting to piety. And then there's all these you know, like you can see why the imagery didn't appeal, at least at that time, at a time of Counter-Reformation. Right, to you know, the sensibilities of people like Cardinal Gabriele Pagliotti. So, wow. But in the end, that's why a lot of the you know, the bodies and stuff were covered. Later yep. on, John Paul II, with his theology of the body, had a lot of those removed. Right,
that's a good point. That's a really good point.
Yeah, you know, because the body also reflects who we are. You know, we're made by God. After all, it's not we shouldn't be ashamed of it. But that's because the sensibilities have evolved. I mean, it's not necessarily wrong. You know?
That's really fascinating background. My guest is Father Eric Nicolai, art historian on the K.O. Clark Show. We've got to take a really, really quick break. I promise we will talk about why some modern art doesn't exactly lead to piety. Let's put it that way. We'll be right back on the K.O. Clark Show after this.
You keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
But the classics on the Cale Clark Show today. So glad to have you with us. My guest is Father Eric Nicolai, art historian. Before we get back to Father Eric, I want to remind you that tomorrow we're very excited to be able to bring you the live broadcast of the Beatification Mass of Father Michael McGivney, the founder of the Knights of Columbus. Be sure to listen tomorrow at 10 a.m. Central on your local Relevant Radio station or online at relevantradio.com. And of course, you can always listen on the Relevant Radio app. So Father Eric Nicolai is joining me on the Cale Clark Show right now. You can call and talk to him, 1-888-914-9149. We're talking about art and faith, and it's been just a really exciting and fascinating conversation walking through history, through Christian art. And when we get to the 20th century, Father, you know, some of the modern, well, I guess what passes for art in terms of church architecture and some forms of art, I know that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but there's only really so far you can push that, in my view. We have a call from Tony, who I think is going to ask you about this. Tony is calling from Paterson, New Jersey. Tony, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine. And thank you so much, Cale, and thank you, Father Nicolai, for taking on this subject. I'm a Catholic sculptor, so nothing is more important to me than this subject. Of the great patrimony of our church, I think, you know, amongst the greatest is the art. The anecdote that I always love the most to explain to people why it's such a powerful experience, the great German poet, Rainer Maria Rilke, when he stood before the Apollo Belvedere for the first time, looked at this great classical sculpture, and after being stunned into silence, he finally said, "Now I must make my whole life over." And he was referring to the fact that the work revealed an order of existence that was so sublime and transcendent that deep calls unto deep, and it calls up something in ourself whereby we feel we must make our life commensurate with the truth, the beauty, the goodness of what we see before us. And it's a metanoia. It's a transformative experience. And I wish that the church would put forward even more the potential of its great art to have this effect on people. But very quickly, my question is, Father Nicolai, you look at this unbelievably great history of great art from the first century up until about the 18th century, the Romanesque, the Gothic, Renaissance. And there's a precipitous decline, in my view. The 18th century was the Age of Enlightenment. We know it had values hostile towards mysticism and spirituality. The 19th century was the century of positivism, scientism, utilitarianism. You had Spencer in England, Herbert Spencer. You had Comte in France. And it seems to me that religion or religious art retreated from the rational ground, saying, like, scientism has won the day. We can't really compete with them. So what we're going to do is play on the feelings and kind of retreat into sentimentality.
Right.
And the first really bad religious art we see in the West is in the 18th and 19th century, and I don't feel we've ever recovered from it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a great question, Tony. What do you have to say about that, Father?
Well, I mean, it kind of depends, of course, to me, in my view, on the subject that you're dealing with. But I know that, especially if we talk about religious art, I know that Jacques Maritain, the famous, he was a good friend of Paul VI, and he was a very influential there during the council. But he had very severely criticized what was called the style of Saint-Sulpice, which is a 19th century style of very saccharine art that was used precisely for churches and would adorn a lot of churches, and also some Norwegian artists, mainly French artists, right? But they would represent scenes from the life of Jesus. And I'm sure you have seen these because they were so mass-produced, right? And he really criticized them because they were characterized by a kind of commercialism, mass-produced, an emotive style, subjective emotions. You know, the typical thing of the saints rolling their eyes to suggest devotion, right? And it was really the word I use is saccharine and overly sentimental, right? And this became very popular, and it's hard to pin down exactly the nature of Saint-Sulpice's style, but that's what it was ended up being called, right? And so it was characterized also by being cheap. Like, you could mass produce it, so you could any church could have one now. You see, in the past, you'd have to pay a lot of money to get a good artist and you'd have to invest a lot in getting good art. Now anybody can just, you know, get a copy of this, you know, this. And so, and so this is in part what led to the lowering of the quality of the art. So Pope Pius X actually introduced ascetics into seminaries, right? Because he saw that many priests at that time, late 19th century, early 20th century, were making decisions about what churches looked like, right? And so he wanted them to at least have a better sensitivity, know about the history of art, right? And he wanted to really rid the churches of this kind, what he called religious mercantilism, right? But unfortunately, what happened after that in the 20th century is that there was an excessive emphasis, I would say, on the personal, let's say, the personal sensitivities or sensibilities of the artist himself, without really thinking of what the purpose is of that art, to move, to clarify, to dictate, not to dictate, but to be didactic, right? And and so that's part of what led to that downfall. But ultimately, I think, you know, to make beautiful art, you have to inherit, on one hand, a tradition, and you have to just invest a lot of time, energy, right? And unfortunately, many people are not ready to do that today. Like, when you look at the effort that is put into they'll build a church, but not always, you know, dedicate that much time to, let's say, I don't know, stained glass or something like that. Right. So I mean, I think, you know, when we think like, for example, you take a tabernacle, right? I mean, the tabernacle is the most sacred part of a church, really. You know, it's where our blessed Lord is kept, right? And very often, these tabernacles, that you just go online, search tabernacles, new tabernacle, wooden tabernacle, like a little, you know, cheaply looked and put together. And this is what we give our Lord, you know, for where he's going to be reserved, right? Older traditions had you know, beautiful gold or silver, because he deserves this, like he deserves a better place, right? And I think that, you know, partly explains why, you know, there's been somewhat of a I guess a superficiality in the art world.
My guest was Father Eric Nicolai today on the show. I really want to thank you for taking the time to join us, by the way, Father. And it's not every day that we get a call from a Catholic sculptor, Tony, calling from Paterson, New Jersey. Tony, I really want to thank you for that call. You're obviously very well-versed in Catholic art, and that was a great answer and a great response by you, Father. Just before we go, we've got a couple minutes left. Karen Moran, who's one of the producers here at Relevant Radio, has a question, and it's this. Do you have any advice or ideas about how we can incorporate good Catholic art into our homes?
How can you incorporate good Catholic art into your homes? Well, that's the thing, is that in my day, when I was studying art history, just to get a look at art was not that easy. You had to go into old dusty volumes, and there were only a few of these that were available. But of course, today you have so much access with the internet, right? And there are, you know, there are many, many sites where you can see this. And I think, you know, you have to search the subject that you want, right? And there are different ways you can do it, but there are many very good artists that simply do reproductions, right, of great, great works, right? And I've decorated chapels like that. I mean, it does sound commercial in a certain sense, but, you know, I'll download a painting off the internet and get somebody to reproduce it, you know? And so then it's, in a certain way, it's painted original, but it's a copy, but it's a painted original, right? So it's not just like a color photocopy or something like that, right? That's a great way to suggest. And especially icons. Icons are really, really, there are stores where you can get beautiful, beautiful icons, and they glitter there. I'm looking at some right now of Our Lady, La Vierge de la Lumière, Our Lady of the Light. You know, it's a beautiful icon. And, you know, I think you got to look at them. Are they helping me to pray? Is this helping me to pray? Right? Is it helping me to be pious? Right?
It's got to lead to piety, right?
Yeah. And it doesn't mean you have to have just religious art everywhere and in the house, but, you know, at least in a room to have an image of Our Lady, maybe a small crucifix, you know, it can help us.
That's a great answer and a great interview all around. Really want to thank you, Father Nicolai, for joining me on the show. It's been a great conversation.
My pleasure.
You can follow Eric Nicolai, Father Eric Nicolai, on his YouTube channel, youtube.com/Eric Nicolai. And also, I really want to encourage you to subscribe to his podcast, In Your Presence, which can be found wherever good podcasts are downloaded. Really want to thank the Top Gun team from The Cale Clark Show, producer Lucas Holt, call screener Patrick Alog, and Karen Moran, who works social media for us all this week. It's been a fantastic week on the show. I hope you all have a blessed weekend, and don't forget to get out there and vote. Don't forget to download Father Rocky's amazing free ebook, Vote Your Conscience, and find out how you can incorporate Catholic truth when you go to the polls. God bless you, everyone. I'm going to let Michaela have the final word. Take it away.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.